to listen to the interviews from Island Life on Saturday the 21st of September 2013. Island Life is our weekly magazine show focusing on Waiheke people, events and issues. It's brought to you every Saturday morning from 10 till 12 by the Humble Pie Village Butchery. You'll find them at 102 Ocean View Road, Oneiroa. On Saturday the 21st of September, David Basham talked to Dr. Sharif Abdullah about societal transformation. He discussed a plan for island street parties with Ewan Sutherland and Michael Tavares, and he found out about an upcoming Beatles review with Pat Ehrlich of the V12 Choir.
My next guest, Sharif Abdullah, he's a university professor, he's an author, works around the world in transformation of societies. Good morning, Sharif.
Good morning, and thank you for having me here.
It's an absolute pleasure. I've just finished reading one of Sharif's books, and the book is called Seven Seeds for a New Society. And quite a bit of what I want to talk to you about today will be around this book. It's fresh in my head. But it's interesting when you talk about your childhood. We both had stutters, which is very interesting. One thing I want to know, what did you learn something from that time with stuttering?
Yes. Part of it was a fear of being in the world, of actually being connected to the world. And part of it is the environment that I was in Camden, New Jersey, which is America's worst city. We're certified at that. It's very difficult being different. And it's actually a bit difficult just trying to stay alive. And the things that you learn are things like resilience, things like how to take care of yourself. But you also learn how to cut yourself off from your environment, cut yourself off from your reality. And those were some things that I had to overcome in time. I had to learn how to do things different. So it's a combination of factors. It was I was sickly as a child. We were very, very, and very poor. Public housing, the whole nine yards. And with all of that, there was a track that I was on. And that track was not to college and not to higher education and not to getting, advanced degrees and things like that. And so, it really had to be a different way, and I had to learn a different way of doing things.
Yeah, because you obviously did, because in your book you state you knew something was wrong right from the beginning with society, and you didn't have the epiphany that you talk that other people seem to have. When was the first recollection you had? How young were you?
I was in single digits when I really started understanding this is not right. I remember an incident. I was about 7 years old. My mother was moving us yet again because poor people move a lot. And she was looking at a house, and the house was boarded up, and there was this big sign on it. And at 7 years old, I could read the word condemned. And the landlord walks up to the house, and he just rips the condemned sign off and pulls the board off, and that was our house. And he saw me looking at it, at the sign, and he says, "Don't worry about it, kid," And I was worried about it. It was like, this isn't right. There's something that's fundamentally wrong with living in condemned housing when others are not. When not having enough to eat. My mother had to make the decision that many poor people have to make, which is having enough money to keep a roof over your head but not feed your children, or having enough money to feed your children and not keep a roof over their head. And in the world that we exist in right now, no human being should have to make that decision. And unfortunately, there are more and more human beings that have to make that decision. So the direction that we're going in as a human society is the wrong direction. And at some point in time, we're going to stop talking about that, and we're going to start doing something about it.
Yeah, in New Zealand, we talk about child poverty. We never used to talk about it. I don't know whether it came to the fore, but I remember being in a very poor family, and we coped because I think everything wasn't that expensive. Wages
exactly.
were reasonable. You could afford it.
Right.
We, and you probably have it in the States, where you sponsor children. Mm-hmm. Now, we're having sponsorship for children in New Zealand.
Right.
So I sponsor a child who lives in New Zealand.
Right.
And we always thought that it was overseas. Now we've got it right here. And child poverty, I mean, I heard a story where we have these things called saveloys, and they're little sausages, and they have a red skin on them. And they had them for dinner, and in the morning for breakfast, they'd have pink soup.
Mm.
And pink soup's the water from that.
Right.
I would just utterly stunned. Reading your book has really, really affected my thinking. It's really made me feel like it's something we've really got to get behind. So what was the first thing you did? Because when you were young, you did some pretty big things.
Well, at the time, when I became political when I was about 12 years old, I led my first demonstration at 12 years old, I was told that the problem was white racism in America, and that the answer was the Black Liberation Movement. So that at that time, at 12 years old, I was trying to create a world that works for all Black people, because all white people were fine. I could see television. Everybody was happy and smoking and getting along with each other. And it took me going to college to realize that the world wasn't right for some white people. And then by the time I got to graduate school, I realized that the world wasn't working for anybody. It wasn't working, and it doesn't work for the people it purports to work for. So we talk about the rich, and the rich are doing this, and the rich are doing that. But when I talk to my rich friends, they have the same problems. They have the same problems of emptiness inside, depression, suicide, all the things that we've talked about in terms of our society, in terms of our world, are being faced by everybody in the world. So there is no us versus them. It's just us. And we together have to find some new directions and a new focus.
Yeah, I can remember meeting a very famous New Zealander. And it was to do with mental health. And he said to me that everyone says, I'd like to be like you. What a wonderful life. He said, if they only knew what was going on in my head, they wouldn't want to be me.
Exactly.
And that was a really interesting thing. To look at the amount of material there is around you, I've decided to sort of cut some corners a bit because I want to get as much out to everybody. And there are some definitions you put in your book that I think would be really helpful to the listeners to get an idea of what you're getting at. These are the breakers, menders, and the keepers. So what do you define as a breaker?
Right. And if I can set a little bit of context first, the thing that we have to change in our society is not our economic system and not our political system. We have to change our consciousness. We have to change the consciousness that created this economic system, the consciousness that created this political system. So the next question is, what is the consciousness that we need to change? I grew up in, again, the Black Power movement, and we saw all of our problems in terms of blacks and whites. Then the women's liberation movement came, and all the problems were defined in terms of men and women, okay? What we realized, though, is that all of us, men and women, whites, blacks, and everybody else, is we have all created and contributed to the problem. So the people... So I look at three different kinds of consciousness on the planet right now. The breakers are those of us who have broken the sacred hoop. The people who, and this is a Native American term, the sacred hoop, that have broken away from the way that we've done things for a million years. that the breakers are the people who are trying to live on top of the earth as opposed to as an integral part of the earth. The keepers are what we call indigenous people, first peoples, etc. These are the people who keep to the sacred ways, who keep to our key core values of love for the earth, love for all relationships, and an awareness that there is more to reality than our five senses are telling us. So those two groups are the groups that the breakers have been the ones that have been basically bulldozing the earth and bulldozing human relationships. The keepers are the ones who have been trying to keep to the sacred ways. And then the third group are those of us who have been raised as breakers. I was raised as a breaker. I speak a breaker language. But we've made a choice. And the choice is that we are going to live our lives differently. The choice is that we're going to live our lives in the value structure of the keepers. The value structures that say, my primary goal is not making more money. My primary goal is enhancing life. My primary goal is enhancing the earth. My primary goal is enhancing my relationships to all other beings, including human beings and all other living beings. And if we can do that, once we pledge ourselves to do that, and once we practice doing that, we're going to find some things start happening. First of all, our hearts open up and we start being larger people, larger in the sense of more connected, more aware of who we are. We start finding that a lot of the mental health issues that we've got will go away because the mental health issues are an integral part of buying into the breaker concepts, the breaker mentality. Now, I don't want to go before we go any further with that. I don't want to say that breakers are wrong and keepers and menders are right. There are times when thinking like a breaker, as an individual, thinking in a command and control structure really works. As I tell folks, when my plane is coming into a landing at the airport, I don't want the cockpit to work as a committee. Okay, I want somebody to be in charge up there, okay? But then there are other times when we need to be cooperative, collaborative. There are times when we need to be connected with other human beings. And there are times when we need to do that in such a way that we are enhancing life and we are enhancing our connection with others.
Thank you. That comes from the book that I've been reading, and it was really interesting because you had all the definitions in the beginning of the book, and from the Seven Seeds for a New Society, you've got the definitions, and it makes reading so much easier. And you've got those lovely little quotes along the side. One of the ones that I've always enjoyed, and it's probably been misused all over the years to suit us, but it's that one where the thinking that got us here today will not be the thinking that gets us out of. And you say in your book, you call it the mess.
Yes.
What is the mess?
Well, the mess was one of my more eloquent moments. When I start realizing, and this is something that happened when I was in a meeting, I was talking about the litany of our problems, our ecological problems, our sociological problems, our psychological problems, our political problems. And there was a young girl, maybe 8 or 9 years old, and when she saw this slide that I put up that had all these 30, 40 categories of problems, this young kid almost jumps out of her skin. She says, "That's it." She said, "All of us kids know there's only one problem, and it has all these different categories to it. This is the first time I've seen an adult recognize that." because each one of us, we want to approach things from our perspective. So if we're into ecology, then all of the problems look like ecological problems. If we're into sustainability, all the problems look like sustainability issues. We don't want to see that it's all one thing. And it's been created by one consciousness, by a consciousness that says, I am separate from you, I'm different from you, and I'm either better than you or I'm worse than you. But that separation is the thing that creates the consciousness. Now, that gets created in our home life. It gets reflected in our home life. It gets reflected in our work life. So most of the times when we think about work, we are thinking about power over structures. We're not thinking about collaboration. We're not thinking about cooperation. We're not thinking about inclusivity, the notion that I am you. And how does that actually work? Now, people talk about this stuff on whatever your religious day is. You know, Christians on Sundays, Muslims on Fridays, Jews on Saturdays. It's like, but outside of Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, how do you actually practice the stuff that we've been talking about in our religions, in our social groups? So our challenge is, how do we actually practice what we already know? And then how do we bring that into all of the structures, not just our work structures, not just our political structures, not just our economic structures? How do we bring it into our foreign policy? How do you have a foreign policy that's based on inclusivity as opposed to separation? We have to keep those people out of here. We have to have power. You know, United States have to have military nuclear weapons to have power over everyone. What happens when we change that to recognize that we are one with all others?
We have something going on right now on the island. I don't have enough time. I could go on for an hour on that subject. We have something on the island. We were having a local board election, and when we were before we got on air, I was talking to you about that. And that seems to be that. I mean, I said to you, I heard someone say, I hate that person. And mm-hmm. I thought, wow, what hope is there when we talk about hate? Mm-hmm. What do you think of this current voting system that has, you've got parties, you've got individuals, people against each other, people taking sides? Where do you think that's going to lead us?
I was listening to some people who are supposedly educated about politics, and they started off their conversation by saying, well, you know, what democracy is majority rule. And that is not what democracy is. Democracy is the rule of the people. And from the founders of democracy, they always believed that there was a consciousness, a connection, a collaboration that that the will of the people is not these two opposing camps fighting each other. Now, that's how people make money. That's how people win elections. And so, therefore, that's become our politics. But it's an aberration of democracy. It isn't what democracy really is. And so what our challenge is how do we create a collective will? And the only way we can do that is to actually talk to each other, not talk about each other, not create these zinger sound bites and things like that, but really to say, what is it that we believe? What is it that we wish to do? Where are we going right now? And the thing that I ask when I put people together in organizations is, what is the world that you want to create for your children and grandchildren? And when you you honestly answer that question, all of a sudden you realize that you've got unanimity. You've got a really connected way of seeing each other, as opposed to, I'm going to propose something I know your side will hate, and if I can get 51% of the vote, I win.
Yeah, and there is something here. I was looking up and I couldn't find it. The quote where you talked about being criticized, don't criticize me, do better.
I'll accept that. Yes.
All right. That just struck me. That was something I was talking to someone about the other day. Mm-hmm. I realize I've caught you with this book because you didn't expect me to be reading this one. This is your newest book, isn't it?
Yes.
And it's where you said in the book, you know, do better than me.
Right.
Don't talk down me. Don't criticize me. Right. But do better.
Right.
And it didn't seem like it wasn't then a criticism. It was, look, if you don't like what I do, get out there and do something bigger.
As I tell people, my personal and organizational vision is that we can create a world that works for all. If you don't like that vision, come up with one of your own. Okay, but don't walk around. Don't just say, "Oh, that's a crazy vision," or "No one could ever do that," etc. Come up with your own vision. If I can share something with you, and this is something that some friends of mine and I put together back in, I think it was 2009. The Tea Party was in America was just getting strong. There's an organization on the left, MoveOn.org, that was very strong. And they were these two groups are polarizing and pulling people apart. So as part of a conference that we were engaged in called Engaging the Other, we called together the leaders of the Tea Party, the leaders of Move On, and the leaders of the Libertarian Party, and said and sat them all around a table. And, you know, the only agreement was no microphones, no recordings. You can talk as honestly as you wish. Nothing's being recorded. And we started it, and I was there, and a couple of other people were there representing the center, representing the neutral ground, representing inclusivity, seeing all these voices as valid, and saying, you know where you disagree. You're spending millions of dollars flooding the airways on how you disagree. Let's spend 2 hours looking at where we possibly can agree. What are the things that we can agree on? And there's a very fertile field where we all can agree. But that's not where political leaders seem like they get their temporary power. So they want the disagreements as opposed to the agreements. As I say in my workshops, if I have 100 people in the room and I say, everybody that's in favor of gay marriage, stand on this side. Everybody's opposed to it, stand on that side. It will polarize the room. If I say, everybody who's in favor of drinking clean water, stand on this side. Everybody who wants to drink dirty, toxic water, stand on that side. All of a sudden, the room comes together. So if you ask the right questions, and again, the operative question of what is the world that you want to leave for your children and your grandchildren, then all of a sudden you get unanimity across these lines. And that is the task that we have right now, across the lines in our political divide, but also across the lines in our businesses, in our workplaces. I'm going to be talking to several different organizational groups while I'm here in New Zealand over the next couple of weeks to talk about what can you do within your own organization to bring people together for the purpose of making the organization stronger, making it more resilient, making it more collaborative, and making it so that we can start even talking about compassion. We can start talking about vision, and a vision that's more than making more money. Okay.
And that's I think it's the Institute of Management, I think, one of them that you're going to be talking to.
Yes.
So are you talking throughout New Zealand or just Auckland?
I'm just in Auckland and Waiheke.
Yeah. We are separate.
Yes, right. Yeah, right.
See, we like to think we're separate.
Right. No, there's nothing wrong with maintaining one's identity. And I think this is a really important point. I am not talking about all of us just kind of becoming porridge together. As having a separate identity, having a separate character, and I've only been on the island for a few hours, and it definitely has a different character from Auckland. But I'm really But we also have to recognize having the different character, we are part of one. We're part of a whole.
Yeah, and I think that's what we'd like to feel. I think sometimes we try and separate ourselves completely, and yet we are part of that whole. We cannot avoid it, but we do have a very separate identity, and we identify it. And it's hard to stay away. I've been away from Waiheke back and came here as a child and still come backwards and forwards, and I'm hoping I'm here forever now. But interesting place.
Yeah, this is my first time here, but hopefully it won't be my last.
Right.
Yeah.
Now, I allowed extra time, as I said to you, and we're still running out of time. You're the director and founder of
Commonway Institute, yes. Yeah.
Tell us a bit about that.
Well, Commonway is a couple of things. It's an organization that's based in the United States, but it's also what I call a public philosophy. A philosophy that says we can create a world that works for all beings. My work includes, as you've mentioned, I teach at the university level. I generally teach within conflict resolution courses, departments, I should say. But I also do a lot of consulting work on the issue of how do you bring inclusivity within organizations. That's the thing that brings me here to Auckland. I've been working for a few years now with my friend and collaborator, Leslie Hamilton, who lives in Auckland. And she and I are doing work around the issue of how can an organization become more inclusive as a way of becoming a better organization. Better, again, in the sense that it becomes profitable, successful, etc., but better in defining a larger scope of what success means, not just I make more money, but everybody is miserable. That's how we define success in America. But to say success is I feel good about where I am. I feel good about the kind of organization I work with. I feel good about the people I'm working with. And we're doing good things, not just making more money.
And this is a question you ask, and it's not TV, but I hold the book up like
they can. I believe hear that. Yes,
I believe. And you say in there, think about your job.
Yes.
Why do you do it? And I was with someone who's very close to me and knows me, and I said, "What about my job?" And they said, "You'd love it." So they knew that's why I do it. I know that I love it.
Yeah.
And I've had other people in the trust that I manage say when I'm away, I miss the place. I'm just hoping that little bit of that's rubbing.
Can I give you two stories on that?
Yeah, sure.
I was working with an organization in Portland, Oregon, which is where I'm based, where I have been based, and this one guy, he's a blue collar worker, drove a truck. He won the lottery, won $7 million. And the next day, he came to work, and they were saying, "You're a multimillionaire now. You don't have to work here anymore." And he says, "I love what I'm doing. I'm doing a good job for the people of Portland, and I want to keep doing it. These are my friends, etc." Now, that's the kind of workplace that the opposite of that is the workplace where people are just trying to get out of it and doing everything they can do to hasten their retirement. The second thing was I was at a hot springs in Oregon, and they were cleaning one of the pools. And so this woman had these big gloves on, this huge brush, and she's scrubbing the algae off the rocks. And she was doing it so intently, I interrupted her and I said, "You really look like you're into what you're doing." And she looked at me and looked at the rocks, and she said, "This is a labor of love. I love what I'm doing." Now, she's getting paid, but that was almost secondary to doing the work. Now, what would happen if in our world we had that attitude that we were making great products, great services. We wanted to do excellent work, and we also happened to get paid for it. You know, so that's the kind of thing. And in that book, I call that relational economics, an economics as though we are actually related to each other, as opposed to I'm trying to get as much work from you and pay you as little as possible, and the workers are trying to do as little work as possible and trying to get paid as much as possible. You know, what happens if we all just sat down together and said we're related to each other? Now let's figure out the right thing to do. That is some of the things that we'll be talking about with organizations and organizational networks over the next couple of weeks.
Well, we've run out of time, and I knew we would. But you are going to be back on the island. You're not doing a workshop on the island, but you are going to be back next weekend.
I'll be back here next weekend, and I'll be doing an informal talk. Anyone who's listening now will be able to come to the Solar Restaurant. I think everybody knows that where that is on Ocean View.
Yeah, it's just up here in Onuroa. Everybody knows
yes. it. Yes, and they have a informal room in the back, and I'll be there. And if you can come, at least two people will be able to continue this conversation, and hopefully we'll get more people to come and take part in the conversation.
Have you worked out which... which day you're doing it?
This will be next Saturday, 2:00.
Okay, Saturday, 2:00.
Yes.
I will make sure people get to know that. We'll have it on our website. We'll make sure that that's advertised, because it's been a joy to have you here. It's been really, really wonderful to talk with you, especially having spent time reading that book from cover to cover in one sitting. I haven't read something in one sitting for a long time, and it was a sheer joy. Thank you very much for coming in.
Well, it's been a joy to be here, and look forward to talking to you next week.
You're listening to Waiheke Radio, 88.3 and 107.4 FM.
We've got Ewan and Michael in here to talk about street parties. So, guys, what's all this movement on Waiheke about street parties?
Hi. Yes, so it started as a discussion on Sherin Brown's local board Facebook campaign page about using public spaces and getting to know your neighbours and reconnecting with the people in your area. And after a short discussion, Ildiko, you and myself and Sherin, we decided that we'd make a time and then put it out to see if people would have these parties on their street, and it just exploded. People have come forward and said they'd love to have one out the front of their house, and they can really vary. So, you know, it could be a picnic blanket out on the verge on the side of the road, some tables, some garage sales, whatever you want. It's really about getting to know your neighbours and celebrating the community that you live in. It's on October the 6th, 2013, 12 to 2. Ewan?
Yeah, well, I got quite excited about it because, living in Surfdale, and the first one that was mooted was on the triangle on Ocean Road and Hamilton Road, and that's just up the street from us. So it seemed perfect, and we already know our neighbours across the road and have had get-togethers where we've got people from the neighbourhood in and had Sunday afternoon soirees, so an outdoor soiree on a reserve seemed like a good idea to me, and I believe there are people down on the bottom of Hamilton Road as well keen to get in amongst it, and I know that we've got at least one ukulele player coming, and so if there's musicians who want to be involved, that would be all the better. But basically, it's just a social event to get to know your neighbours, really. And in terms of times of crisis, it either personal or whether there's a civil crisis or whatever, it's always a good thing to know who your neighbours are and support.
I was talking to Sharif, and I was saying to that I'd reviewed a book for Mental Health Week. Mental Health Week is in October, and it's about connectedness. That's the theme, and this book was about connectedness and major disasters. And they used really big ones like Katrina. And they found the more connected a society a group were, the better they recovered and the better they did. And some of the poorest parts of New Orleans who had real connectedness recovered better than some of the richer parts that had no connectedness. So you're absolutely right on the nail.
And we'd be naive to think that we're immune to these sort of disasters, especially on Waiheke, where we're reliant on power from the mainland, et cetera, the list goes on and on and on. If we know our neighbours and know where to go when we need support, then that's all the better.
And you're meeting for a different purpose, isn't it? It's to enjoy yourself.
Exactly.
It's not a political party.
No, it's not at all. No.
It's not a protest meeting. It's just something that gets together with a common purpose.
Yeah, let's bring your food. Have a good time. Yep. And have a good time.
Let's know each other. Mm-hmm. I've been on the island just under 3 years now, and one of the impressions I got of the place when I first arrived was that this is a well-connected community and with good, strong connections. But that's something that should be always celebrated and always worked on for times of crisis, but also at all times. A community is stronger when it's more connected.
It'll be surprising though when you work on the radio and volunteer and you people and you get to meet lots of people. There are groups. There are a certain group here and a certain group here, and you find that comes out at election time. But there are certain groups, and I don't even think those groups talk to each other. So it'd be nice to meet on a totally different purpose and get people actually connecting with each other.
I guess as a Waiheke-wide thing, we have the Saturday market where people get together, but this is more of a personal, intimate thing in the street. And I know there's people interested in Karaka Street or Karaka Road, Putaki Road, as I said, Hamilton, and KP. Meslin Road down there.
I know where lots of roads are, but I only know where you live, but yeah. I struggle to remember what street you live in, and then you know, because that's how I grew up here, knowing where people were, not the names of the streets.
Yeah, of course, and there's Ocean View Road, not to be confused with Ocean Road in Surfdale. But there is information on Facebook at All Around Waiheke Street Party, if people want to go and have a look at others who are making suggestions on there about, you know, wanting to get together and get something off the ground too in their particular areas. So by all means, have a look.
Right. So when is this one that you've been talking about, the one October 6th?
October 6th, 12 till 2.
And whereabouts is that?
There are everywhere. This is the great thing about this is not a top-down organization thing. We've just put it out there that let's have street parties on this particular day, and it's come literally. It's sprouted out of the ground like seeds. These parties are just popping up all over the island. And if I could just tell a little story about that demonstrates the grassroots nature of this. The Putiki Point Residents Association is something that's just recently formed down at Shelley Beach Road. Their constitution is that they have no meetings, only parties. And they had a spontaneous street party last Saturday, the 14th, where they played a documentary about Bill Belcher, a sailor that tried to sail from here across to Murwillumbah in Queensland, got shipwrecked on a reef in the middle of nowhere. And they're going to be holding those parties again. So there's total freedom. If your street has its own particular character, have a street party that reflects that particular character of your street. Organized from the bottom up, October the 6th, 12 to 2 p.m. Find out more about it on the Facebook page, the All Around Waiheke Street Party.
I've looked at the logistics of Seaview Road where I live. My ex-wife lives at one end.
Have it in one of the potholes. Yeah.
My ex-wife lives at one end and I live at the other. So it's a long road. We'll have to divide it up to be having street parties. But when I lived in Esalen Road down KP Way, KP if you were selling, of course, Surfdale if you were buying. we used to have a Christmas party in the grass area in the middle, and when I first lived there, they were out there mowing the lawn, and I thought, what are they doing all these things for? And suddenly up sprouts up tents and a marquee, and they'd go for quite a long time. They were good drinkers, and they had a great time, you know, barbecues and things. So they were doing it in the street and had done it for a long time, because we found we'd go down our driveway, and some of us had long driveways, and you wouldn't see anybody, and you drive in cars, nope, hardly anyone walked. The cars would just come in and go down. You wouldn't know your next door neighbour.
No, and certainly around Waiheke, there are a lot of reserves and opportunities for people to get together in these open spaces and carry it off.
So the 6th of October, that's the day, 12 to 2, that people are going to kick off.
Sunday afternoon.
Yes.
Of course, nothing stopping people having parties any other time they like.
Yeah, exactly.
That's right.
Or if there's no reserve, particularly if somebody's got a front yard or a big deck or something, you know, or if they're little short streets, like there is Short Street in Surftale.
That's the one.
That they're more like little community groups get together, you know.
It's not okay. It's a really good idea to be able to do it. It's interesting that we need this sort of thing to get going. But getting to know each other, we're a busy life. Mm. You know, we all commute. There's the commuters, and they're off commuting in the dark often. And then the people that stay on the island, we meet up here, and because we go into a coffee bar and we see each other. But there are different groups. I remember when I commuted, you mix a lot with the commuters. I've still got friends from those days. And so it is good to have that, because when I stopped commuting, I had to meet a whole lot of new people. It was really interesting.
Yeah, I suppose, too, for people who are new to the island, it's going to be interesting for them to get to know their neighbours. I know just through the bamboo hedge at ours, there are new neighbours, so I'll be knocking on their door and telling them to get along. So, yeah, it's good.
Okay, well, thanks, guys, for coming in. It's a great thing. We'll make sure that it gets out there as well on Waiheke Radio. So 6th of October, 12 to 2, there could be parties all over the place. Well, thanks for coming in.
Waiheke Radio. We've
got Pat Ehrlich in the studio, and he's going to be talking to us about what V12 are going to be doing.
Morning, David. Yeah, V12 and friends are going to be... we've got a big concert coming up this weekend or next weekend, 28th and 29th of this month at the Waiheke High School Hall, featuring songs only by the Beatles. Yep, so it's a nearly two-hour show. A little bit of acting thrown in. Also, now people will have seen V12, the male choir, as in an a cappella choir, as in unaccompanied. But in the second set of the show, we'll be bringing in guitars. We'll end up with a full band, actually. We've got a little bit of an Irish feel going on there in some places as well. Won't tell you what song, but we've sort of given our own interpretation to a few of the Beatles songs. Yeah, so...
Oh, that's really great. It must be very difficult to take songs that are well known and to arrange them for V12, because there's no accompaniment.
Well, yeah, the thing is, for a lot of Beatles songs, the harmonies are kind of already in there. I mean, they're known for their harmonies, aren't they? I mean, the first time I heard the Beatles, I was, what, 6 or something like that, and that was the thing that knocked me out was, oh, my God, how can they sound so good? You know, two voices, how can two voices sound that great? So I've taken that concept and tried just to expand upon it a little bit. So I've usually had to add, for example... a bass line, like the bass is, of course, on the Beatles songs, the bass line is played by a bass guitar, you know, Paul McCartney, great bass player. Especially in the a cappella set, we don't have a bass guitar, so we have to get the bass players to do it. The bass singers to sing the bass line. So I've taken the bass line and pretty much tried to recreate it note for note, really. There's some songs like... Nowhere Man, where we've just taken, because it's a three-part harmony originally, and we've just taken those three perfect lines, and that's what we're singing, and it sounds really well. I think it sounds pretty damn good myself.
I can hear that now.
Yeah,
I mean,
yeah.
It's really perfect lines.
You know.
Yeah, perfect, yeah. Perfect lines for having.
Yeah, it's already written. Yeah. That one's already beautifully written. Yeah. And we don't have to do it. I didn't have to do any arranging for that. But as I say, for most of the songs, I've had to maybe invent a line here or like just to pad it out a little bit, especially for the unaccompanied stuff. Yeah.
Yeah, I was very tempted to sing it then, but I don't think the would really appreciate
they know the song.
That. Yeah.
He's a real nowhere man. sitting in his nowhere land. So you got that line, and then above that, he's a real nowhere man, sitting in his nowhere land. And below it, he's a real nowhere man. And so you got the three lines all working together, and oh man, it's something else.
Yeah. Well, were there, is there any particular challenges with the Beatles music to get that a cappella?
Well, the thing is, when you listen to Beatles songs and you listen to the harmonies, you think, oh, that's pretty simple stuff. But when you actually break it down, one of the reasons why the Beatles stood out so much is because they did the unusual but made it sound so palatable, so listenable, that you just think it's easy. But the actual notes themselves, some of the places they go in their harmonies are actually very unexpected. And I was surprised and a little challenged by that whole thing. And I'm like, and I'll tell you, I learned a little bit. I'll be stealing from them a little bit, you know, in the future. Right. They pick intervals and notes that you might not think would be the first choice. Well, it wouldn't be my first choice, but they did it better. You know what I mean? So I'm learning as I go.
Right. Mm. Yeah, because it's interesting, because it's a bit of fun. You said you were 6 years old when you heard the Beatles.
Yep.
Gosh, I didn't know it was way back in the 40s. No. I'm thinking about me. I'm thinking about me. I think I was about 16 or something. So there's 10 years difference.
Yeah, I was born in 61.
I was born in 45, so it was a long time before.
You're kidding me, really?
Yep, born in 40, God. 45.
You wear it well, Dave.
Thank you. Another song. So how long have you been...
Well, we've been at this since the beginning of the year, really.
Right.
Because, I mean, we have 27 songs, new songs to learn, and to learn, hopefully, to a reasonable standard, yeah. Mm.
So I asked a question of myself and almost tried to answer it, because I remember out at Rocky Bay, I talked to you that night that you had the concert, and that was a long time ago now.
Yes.
And you were talking about it then. It seems to have time's gone really quickly, but
was that last year?
When you did the Rocky Bay one,
we've done a few Rocky Bays.
I think it was the one where they had the big supper, the big cake and coffee, and it was an enormous.
That would have been last year. Yeah. I would say late last year. We were talking about it then. Yeah. Certainly. Yeah. We've been pretty early in the year. We've decided on a repertoire on that, and that's the other thing with the Beatles. So many awesome songs that you got to drop some stuff that people are going, oh, why didn't you do that? Because if we did that, we wouldn't be able to do this. You know what I mean? So I know the Beatles had 27 songs, but the thing is, they're all awesome. Every song is just a work of art. So,
I think it'd be interesting to hear people, you know, because the Beatles sometimes now to younger people are just considered to be nothing that's really that much of importance, but really.
But once the youngsters get their teeth, their oral teeth, their ears into a bit of Beatles, they'll discover the tunes, you know, and the harmonies. And some of the beats as well are pretty damn good. But look, David, a great tune is a great tune is a great tune. And I find I've got daughters who in their they're like 19 and 21 now, but and they're going back to the old music. When they were teenagers, they were listening to Lynyrd Skynyrd and stuff like that, you know what I mean? Because a great tune is a great tune is a great tune, you know? It doesn't matter what the era is or what particular production is fashionable at that particular time or era, you know, the song is the song is the song, you know?
Yeah. Well, I've got an album of... two or three albums of jazz-type Beatles songs, and they translate beautifully.
They do. That's another thing with a great song. You can do it in all sorts of different styles, different instrumentation, and it's still good.
Yeah, I've even got one, the Bossa Nova Beatles.
And the Boss, yeah. I'm trying to imagine that. I love you, yeah. She loves you.
But it does translate.
It kind of does, yeah. So I must tell you, too, we've got... a kids' choir. I've been training them up because to do the songs by Ringo Starr. Of course, I don't know what was it with Ringo Starr and Water. So we're doing Yellow Submarine and Octopus's Garden.
Oh, love them!
And the kids are doing those, you know, along with so V12 are backing them up really, and they'll also be involved. The kids will also be involved in a rather lovely song called She's Leaving Home.
That's such a lovely.
And so the kids are going to be doing the the, you know, the high bit that they do in falsetto in the Beatles. And we've got John Keynes, who's a lovely singer, lovely soloist, the lead singer of the Plastic Patties. He'll be soloing on that song.
Oh, because he does some beautiful solos.
That's right.
Beautiful.
Danny Boy was
heart-rending.
He's got
stuff,
one of those, what do you call those lilty Irish type voices that brings a tear to the eye.
And he did that at Stefano's.
Stefano's.
And that was just heart-rending.
You think that was heart-rending? You wait till you hear this. With the kids coming in and everything, it's like, oh my God, I have trouble holding it together.
Oh, wonderful. Totally. Okay, so when is it? Next weekend?
Next weekend, the 28th, 7 o'clock in the evening. Tickets available from iSight. If you can't make it on the Saturday night or you've got kids, bring them along on Sunday afternoon at 2 o'clock.
I'm going to be on, I think I'm going to be at the Sunday one.
Right.
Because I, with... Dennis Bull in the audience, sometimes his wife
in the choir,
sometimes his wife just feels like she sits on her own, so I'm sort of the surrogate person that comes along but I thoroughly enjoy the choir. I just think it is stunning. I sit there envious because I'm the only one in my family that can't sing. It makes me feel
we're quite proud that we started with nothing and we built it up maybe 4 or 5 years ago from nothing and made it what it is today, and people are, I believe, genuinely entertained by the choir and come away with, having felt something, which is, of course, the idea of all music,
Well, great. Thanks for coming in, Pat. And we're going to go out with Penny Lane. I don't know whether you're going to be doing Penny Lane.
It was that or Eleanor Rigby, and we actually went for Eleanor
Rigby. Well, I wouldn't know which one to choose because they're both two of my
favourites. We had it on the original list.
Eleanor Rigby is just a great stunningly...
It was in my English curriculum at school. It was in the textbook.
Okay, thanks, Pat.
See you all there.
You've been listening to the interviews from Island Life, our weekly look at Waiheke people, events and issues, every Saturday morning from 10 till 12, with interviews repeated on Wednesdays at 7 p.m. and Thursdays at 12:30 p.m. Island Life is brought to you by The Village Butchery, the place to go for great cuts of meat and friendly service. You'll find them at 102 Ocean View Road, Onirua.